well-oiled hair. The effect was very brilliant. Very gay clothes, with many reds and greens and yellows. In most instances there would be an apron of one color with a vivid horizontal stripe of a contrasting but harmonious color. Then there was the earring at the left ear, its size depending on the rank of the wearer. And should have absolutely equal rights with men, but in the running of the house mother went further than that and was the undisputed dictator, an autocrat who knew what she wanted and always got it. In the stir and flurry of preparing the house and the grounds for the party she was indeed in her element. There was organizing to be done, commands to be given, and new schemes to outshine the neighbors to be thought out. She excelled at this, having traveled extensively with father to India, Peking, and Shanghai. She had a wealth of foreign thought at her disposal. The date having been decided for the party, invitations were carefully written out by monk scribes on the thick, handmade paper, which was always used for communications of the highest importance. Each invitation was about 12 inches wide by about 2 feet long. Each invitation bore father's family seal, and, as mother also was of the upper ten, her seal had to go on as well. Father and mother had a joint seal, this bringing the total to 3. The invitations were most imposing documents. It frightened me immensely to think that all this fuss was solely about me. I did not know that I was really of secondary importance, and that the social event came first. And told that the magnificence of the party would confer great prestige upon my parents, it would have conveyed absolutely nothing to me, so I went on being frightened. Engaged special messengers to deliver these invitations. Each man was mounted on a thoroughbred horse, each carried a cleft stick, in which was lodged an invitation. The stick was surmounted by a replica of the family coat of arms. The sticks were gaily decorated with printed prayers which waved in the wind. There was pandemonium in the courtyard as all the messengers got ready to leave at the same time. The attendants were hoarse with shouting, horses were neighing, and the huge black mastiffs were barking madly. There was a last-minute gulping of Tibetan beer before the mugs were put down with a clatter as the ponderous main gates rumbled open, and the troop of men with wild yells galloped out to deliver a written message, but also give an oral version which may be quite different. In days of long ago, bandits would waylay messengers and act upon the written message, perhaps attacking an ill-defended house or procession. It became the habit to write a misleading message which often lured bandits to where they could be captured. This old custom of written and oral messages was a survival of the past. Now, sometimes the two messages would differ, but the oral version was always accepted as correct. At the house everything was bustle and turmoil. The walls were cleaned and recolored, the floors were scraped and the wooden boards polished until they were really dangerous to walk upon. The carved wooden altars in the main rooms were polished and reliquored, and many new butter lamps were put in use. Lamps were gold and some were silver, but they were all polished so much that it was difficult to see which was which. All the time mother and the head steward were hurrying around, criticizing here, ordering there, and generally giving the servants a miserable time. Had more than 50 servants at the time, and others were engaged for the forthcoming occasion. They were all kept busy, but they all worked with a will. Even the courtyard was scraped until the stones shone as if newly quarried. Spaces between them were filled with colored material to add to the gap appearance. When all this was done, the unfortunate servants were called before mother and commanded to wear only the cleanest of clean clothes. In the kitchens there was tremendous activity. Food was being prepared in enormous quantities. It is a natural refrigerator. Food can be prepared and kept for an almost indefinite time. The climate is very, very cold, and dry with it. But even when the temperature rises, the dryness keeps stored food good. Meat will keep for about a year, while grain keeps for hundreds of years. Buddhists do not kill, so the only meat available is from animals which have fallen over cliffs, or been killed by accident. Our larders were well stocked with such meat. There are butchers in Tibet, but they are of an untouchable caste, and the more orthodox families do not deal with them at all. I had decided to give the guests a rare and expensive treat. She was going to give them preserved rhododendron blooms. Weeks before, servants had ridden out from the courtyard to go to the foothills of the Himalaya where the choicest blooms were to be found. In our country, rhododendron trees grow to a huge size, and with an astonishing variety of colors and scents. Those blooms which have not quite reached maturity are picked and most carefully washed. Carefully, because if there is any bruising, the preserve will be ruined. Each flower is immersed in a mixture of water and honey in a large glass jar, with special care to avoid trapping any air. The jar is sealed, and every day for weeks after the jars are placed in the sunlight and turned at regular intervals, so that all parts of the flower are adequately exposed to the light. The flower grows slowly, and becomes filled with nectar manufactured from the honey water. People like to expose the flower to the air for a few days before eating, so that it dries and becomes a little crisp, but without losing flavor or appearance. These people also sprinkle a little sugar on the petals to imitate snow. Other grumbled about the expense of these preserves. "We could have bought 10 yak with calves for what you have spent on these pretty flowers," he said. Mother's reply was typical of women. "Don't be a fool, we must make a show, and anyhow, this is my side of the house." Another delicacy was shark's fin. This was brought from China, sliced up and made into soup. Someone had said that shark's fin soup is the world's greatest gastronomic treat. To me, the stuff tasted terrible. It was an ordeal to swallow it, especially as by the time it reached Tibet, the original shark owner would not have recognized it. To state it mildly, it was slightly off. To some, seemed to enhance the flavor. Succulent young bamboo shoots, also brought from China. These could be cooked in various ways, but I preferred them raw with just a dab of salt. My choice was just the newly opening yellow-green ends. I am afraid that many shoots, before cooking, lost their ends in a manner at which the cook could only guess and not prove. Rather a pity, because the cook also preferred them that way. Cooks in Tibet are men. Women are no good at stirring tsampa, or making exact mixtures. Women take a handful of this, slap in a lump of that, and season with hope that it will be right. Men are more thorough, more painstaking, and so better cooks, and are all right for dusting, talking, and, of course, for a few other things. Not for making tsampa, though. Tsampa is the main food of Tibetans. People live on tsampa and tea from their first meal in life to their last. It's made from barley, which is roasted to a nice crisp golden brown. Then the barley kernels are cracked so that the flour is exposed. Then it is roasted again. This flour is then put in a bowl, and hot buttered tea is added. The mixture is stirred until it attains the consistency of dough. Salt, borax, and yak butter are added to taste. The result, tsampa, can be rolled into slabs, made into buns, or even molded into decorative shapes. It is monotonous stuff alone, but it really is a very compact, concentrated food which will sustain life at all altitudes and under all conditions. While some servants were making tsampa, others were making butter. Our butter making methods could not be commended on hygienic grounds. Our churns were large goat skin bags, with the hair inside, with yak or goat milk, and the neck was then twisted, turned over, and tied to make it leak proof. The whole thing was then bumped up and down until butter was formed at a special butter making floor which had stone protuberances about 18 inches high. The bags full of milk were lifted and dropped onto these protuberances, which had the effect of churning the milk. Monotonous to see and hear perhaps 10 servants lifting and dropping these bags hour after hour. There was the andron as the bag was lifted, and the squashy zunk as it was dropped. Sometimes a carelessly handled or old bag would burst. I remember one really hefty fellow who was showing off his strength, working twice as fast as anyone else, and the veins were standing out on his neck with the exertion. Said, "You are getting old, Timon. You are slowing up." Timon grunted with rage and grasped the neck of the bag in his mighty hands, lifted it, and dropped the bag down. But his strength had done its work. The bag dropped, but Timon still had his hands, and the neck, in the air, square on the stone protuberance dropped the bag. Up shot a column of half-formed butter. Straight into the face of a stupefied Timon it went, into his mouth, eyes, ears, and hair, running down his body, covering him with 12 to 15 gallons of golden slush. Attracted by the noise, rushed in. It was the only time I have known her to be speechless. It may have been rage at the loss of the butter, or because she thought the poor fellow was choking, but she ripped off the torn goat skin and thwacked poor Timon over the head with it. He lost his footing on the slippery floor, and dropped into the spreading butter mess. Clumsy workers, such as Timon, could ruin the butter. If they were careless when plunging the bags onto the protruding stones, they would cause the hair inside the bags to tear loose and become mixed with the butter. Minded picking a dozen or two hairs out of the butter, but whole wads of it was frowned upon. Such butter was set aside for use in the lamps or for distribution to beggars, who would heat it and strain it through a piece of cloth. Also set aside for beggars were the mistakes in culinary preparations. If a household wanted to let the neighbors know what a high standard was set, really good food was prepared and set before the beggars as mistakes. These happy, well-fed gentlemen would then wander round to the other houses saying how well they had eaten. The neighbors would respond by saying that the beggars had a very good meal. There is much to be said for the life of a beggar in Tibet. They never want. By using the tricks of their trade they can live exceedingly well. There's no disgrace in begging in most of the eastern countries. Many monks beg their way from Lamasery to Lamasery. It is a recognized practice and is not considered any worse than is, say, collecting for charities in other countries. Those who feed a monk on his way are considered to have done a good deed. Beggars, too, have their code. If a man gives to a beggar, that beggar will stay out of the way and will not approach the donor again for a certain time. Two priests attached to a household also had their part in the preparations for the coming event. They went to each animal carcass in our larders and said prayers for the souls of the animals who had inhabited those bodies. It was our belief that if an animal was killed, even by accident, and eaten, humans would be under a debt to that animal. Such debts were paid by having a priest pray over the animal body in the hope of ensuring that the animal reincarnated into a higher status in the next life upon earth. In the lamasaries and temples some monks devoted their whole time praying for animals. Had the task of praying over the horses, before a long journey, prayers to avoid the horses becoming too tired. In this connection, our horses were never worked for 2 days together. Was ridden on one day, then it had to be rested the next day. Same rule applied to the work animals. All knew it. If, by any chance a horse was picked for riding, and it had been ridden the day before, it would just stand still and refuse to move. Was removed, it would turn away with a shake of the head as if to say, well, I'm glad that injustice has been removed. Donkeys were worse. They would wait until they were loaded, and then they would lie down and try to roll on the load. Three cats, and they were on duty all the time. One lived in the stables and exercised a stern discipline over the mice. Be very wary mice to remain mice and not cat food. Another cat lived in the kitchen. Was elderly, and a bit of a simpleton. Mother had been frightened by the guns of the young husband expedition in 1904, and he had been born too soon and was the only one of the litter to live. Appropriately, he was called Young Husband. Cat was a very respectable matron who lived with us. Was a model of maternal duty, and did her utmost to see that the cat population was not allowed to fall. When not engaged as nurse to her kittens, she used to follow mother about from room to room. She was small and black, and in spite of having a hearty appetite, she looked like a walking skeleton. Animals are not pets, nor are they slaves. They are beings with a useful purpose to serve. Being with rights just as human beings have rights. According to Buddhist belief, all animals, all creatures in fact, have souls, and are reborn to earth in successively higher stages. Quickly the replies to our invitations came in. Men came galloping up to our gales brandishing the cleft messenger sticks. Down from his room would come the steward to do honor to the messenger of the nobles and would snatch his message from the stick and gasp out the verbal version. Saget the knees and sink to the ground with exquisite histrionic art to indicate that he had given all his strength to deliver his message to the house of Ranpa. Would play their part by crowding round with many clerks. Poor fellow, he made a wonderfully quick journey, burst his heart with the speed, no doubt. Poor, noble fellow, I once disgraced myself completely by piping up. Oh no, he hasn't. I saw him resting a little way out so that he could make a final dash. Be discreet to draw a veil of silence over the painful scene which followed. At last the day arrived, the day I dreaded, when my career was to be decided for me, with no choice on my part. The first rays of the sun were peeping over the distant mountains when a servant dashed into my room. What up yet, Tuesday Lobsang Rampa? My, you are a liar. 1 o'clock. And there is much to be done. Get up. I pushed aside my blanket and got to my feet. For me this day was to point the path of my life. In Tibet, two names are given, the first being the day of the week on which one was born. I was born on a Tuesday, So Tuesday was my first name, then Lobsang, that was the name given to me by my parents. But if a boy should enter a lamasery, he would be given another name, his monk name. I to be given another name? Passing hours would tell. At 7, wanted to be a boatman swaying and tossing on the river Tsangpo, 40 miles away. But wait a minute. Did I? Boatmen are of low caste because they use boats of yak hide stretched over wooden formers. Boatman. Low caste? No, I wanted to be a professional flyer of kites. That was better, to be as free as the air, much better than being in a degrading little skin boat drifting on a turgid stream. A kite flyer, that is what I would be, and make wonderful kites with huge heads and glaring eyes. But today the priest astrologers would have their say. Perhaps I'd left it a bit late. I could not get out of the window and escape now. They would soon send men to bring me back. No, after all, I was a ramper, and had to follow the steps of tradition. Be the astrologers would say that I should be a kite flyer. Wait and see. To the end of my childhood. Ow, Yeljai, you are pulling my head off. I shall be as bald as a monk if you don't stop. Hold your peace, Tuesday Lobsang. Your pigtail must be straight and well buttered, or your honorable mother will be after my skin. Yeljai, you don't have to be so rough. You are twisting my head off. Oh, I can't bother about that. I'm in a hurry. There I was, sitting on the floor, with a tough man servant winding me up by the pigtail. Eventually the wretched thing was as stiff as a frozen yak, and shining like moonlight on a lake. Mother was in a whirl, moving round so fast that I felt almost as if I had several mothers. There were last-minute orders, final preparations, and much excited talk. Yasuo, 2 years older than I, was bustling about like a woman of 40. He'd shut himself in his private room and was well out of the uproar. I wished I could have joined him. His and mother had arranged for us to go to the Jokang, the cathedral of Lhasa. Apparently we had to give a religious atmosphere to the later proceedings. 10 in the morning, Tibetan times are very elastic, a triple-toned gong was sounded to call us to our assembly point. Mounted ponies, father, mother, Yasuo, and about 5 others, including a very reluctant me. We turned across the Linka Road, and left at the foot of the Potala. This is a mountain of buildings, 400 feet high and 1200 feet long. Past the village of Sho we went, along the plain of the Kaiachu, until half an hour later we stood in front of the Jokang. Around it clustered small houses, shops and stalls to lure the pilgrims. 1300 years the cathedral had stood here to welcome the devout. Inside, the stone floors were grooved inches deep by the passage of so many worshippers. Pilgrims moved reverently around the inner circuit, each turning the hundreds of prayer wheels as they passed, and repeating incessantly the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Huge wooden beams, black with age, supported the roof, and the heavy odor of constantly burning incense drifted around like light summer clouds at the crest of a mountain. The walls were golden statues of the deities of our faith. Stout metal screens, with a coarse mesh so as not to obstruct the view, protected the statues from those whose cupidity overcame their reverence. But the more familiar statues were partly buried by the precious stones and gems which had been heaped around them by the pious who had sought favors. Candlesticks of solid gold held candles which burned continually, and whose light had not been extinguished during the past 1300 years. From dark recesses came the sounds of bells, gongs, and the lowing bray of the conches. We made our circuit as tradition demanded. Our devotions completed, we went on to the flat roof. Only the favored few could visit here. Father, as one of the custodians, always game. Our form of governments, yes, plural, may be of interest. At the head of the state and church, the final court of appeal, there was the Dalai Lama. None in the country could petition him. Petition or request was fair, or if an injustice had been done, the Dalai Lama saw that the request was granted, or the injustice rectified. Not unreasonable to say that everyone in the country, probably without exception, either loved or revered him. As an autocrat, he used power and domination, but never did he use these for his own gain, only for the good of the country. He knew of the coming communist invasion, even though it lay many years ahead, and temporary eclipse of freedom. That is why a very small number of us were specially trained so that the arts of the priests should not be forgotten. After the Dalai Lama there were two councils, That is why I wrote governments as was the ecclesiastical council or members of it were monks of lama status responsible, under the inmost one, for all the affairs of the lamasaries and nunneries. All ecclesiastical matters came before them. The council of ministers came next. This council had four members, three lay and one cleric. They dealt with the affairs of the country as a whole, and were responsible for integrating the church and state to officials, who may be termed prime ministers, for that is what they were, acted as liaison officers between the two councils, and put their views before the Dalai Lama. Were of considerable importance during the rare meetings of the National Assembly. It was a body of some 50 men representing all the most important families and lamasaries in Lhasa. They met only during the gravest emergencies, such as in 1904, when the Dalai Lama went to Mongolia when the British invaded Lhasa. In connection with this, many Western people have the strange notion that the inmost one was cowardly in running away. He did not run away. Wars on Tibet may be likened to a game of chess. King is taken, the game is won. The Lama was our king. Without him there would be nothing to fight for. He had to go to safety in order to keep the country together. To accuse him of cowardice in any form simply do not know what they are talking about. The National Assembly could be increased to nearly 400 members when all the leaders from the provinces came in. Five provinces, the capital, as Lhasa was often called, was in the province of Yutsang. Shigatse is in the same district. Gutuk is western Tibet, Chang is northern Tibet, while Kham and Odzong are the eastern and southern provinces respectively. Passage of the years the Dalai Lama increased his power and did more and more without assistance from the councils or assembly. Never was the country better governed. View from the temple roof was superb. To the east stretched the plain of Lhasa, green and lush and dotted with trees. Water sparkled through the trees, the rivers of Lhasa tinkling along to join the Tsangpo 40 miles away. The north and south rose the great mountain ranges enclosing our valley and making us seem secluded from the rest of the world. Lamasaries abounded on the lower levels. Higher, the small hermitages perched precariously on precipitous slopes. Westwards loomed the twin mountains of the Potala and Chakpori, the latter was known as the Temple of Medicine. Between these mountains the western gate glinted in the cold morning light. The sky was a deep purple emphasized by the pure white of the snow on the distant mountain ranges. Wispy clouds drifted high overhead. Much nearer, in the city itself, we looked down on the council hall nestling against the northern wall of the cathedral. The treasury was quite near, and surrounding it all were the stalls of the traders and the market in which one could buy almost anything. Close by, slightly to the east, a nunnery jostled the precincts of the disposers of the dead. In the cathedral grounds there was the never-ceasing babble of visitors to this, one of the most sacred places of Buddhism. The chatter of pilgrims who had travelled far, and who now brought gifts in the hope of obtaining a holy blessing. There were who brought animals saved from the butchers, and purchased with scarce money. Is much virtue in saving life, of animal and of man, and much credit would accrue. As we stood gazing at the old, but ever new scenes, we heard the rise and fall of monks' voices in psalmody, the deep bass of the older men and the high treble of the acolytes. In the rumble and boom of the drums and the golden voices of the trumpets, skirlings, and muffled throbs, and a sensation as of being caught up in a hypnotic net of emotions pulled around dealing with their various affairs, some with yellow robes and some in purple. The more numerous were in russet red. These were the ordinary monks. Of much gold were from the Potala, as were those in cherry vestments in white, and police monks in dark maroon bustled about. All, or nearly all, had one thing in common: no matter how new their robes, they almost all had patches which were replicas of the patches on Buddha's robes. Foreigners who have seen Tibetan monks, or have seen pictures of them, sometimes remark on the patched appearance. The patches, then, are part of the dress. Monks of the 1200-year-old Nisar Lamasri do it properly and have their patches of a lighter shade. The red robes of the order, there are many shades of red caused by the manner in which the woolen cloth is dyed. Maroon to brick red, it is still red. Certain official monks employed solely at the Potala wear gold sleeveless jackets over their red robes. Gold is a sacred color in Tibet. Gold is untarnishable and so always pure, and it is the official color of the Dalai Lama. Some monks, or high lamas in personal attendance on the Dalai Lama, are permitted to wear gold robes over their ordinary ones. As we looked over the roof of the Jokang, we could see many such gold-jacketed figures, and rarely one of the peak officials. We looked up at the prayer flags fluttering, and at the brilliant domes of the cathedral. Sky looked beautiful, purple, with little flecks of wispy clouds, as if an artist had lightly flicked the canvas of heaven with a white-loaded brush. Mother broke the spell. "Well, we're wasting time. I shudder to think what the servants are doing. Hurry." So off on our patient ponies, clattering along the Linker Road, each step bringing me nearer to what I termed the ordeal, but which Mother regarded as her big day. Back at home, Mother had a final check of all that had been done, and then we had a meal to fortify us for the events to come. We well knew that at times such as these, the guests would be well filled and well satisfied, but the poor hosts would be empty. No time for us to eat later. With much clattering of instruments, the monk musicians arrived and were shown into the gardens. They were laden with trumpets, clarinets, gongs, and drums. Their cymbals were hung round their necks. To the gardens they went, with much chatter, and called for beer to get them into the right mood for good playing. For the next half hour there were horrible honks, and strident bleats from the trumpets as the monks prepared their instruments. War broke out in the courtyard as the first of the guests was sighted, riding in an armed cavalcade of men with fluttering pennants. The entrance gates were flung open, and two columns of our servants lined each side to give welcome to the arrivals. It was on hand with his two assistants, who carried an assortment of the silk scarves, which are used in Tibet as a form of salutation. There are 8 qualities of scarves, and the correct one must be presented or offense may be implied. Ma gives, and receives, only the first grade. We call these scarves kata, and the method of presentation is this: the donor, if of equal rank, stands well back with the arms fully extended. The recipient also stands well back with arms extended. The donor makes a short bow and places the scarf across the wrists of the recipient, who bows, takes the scarf from the wrists, turns it over in approval, and hands it to a servant. In the case of a donor giving a scarf to a person of much higher rank, he or she kneels with tongue extended, a Tibetan greeting similar to lifting the hat, and places the kata at the feet of the recipient, and in such cases places his scarf across the neck of the donor. Gifts must always be accompanied by the appropriate kata, as must letters of congratulation. The government used yellow scarves in place of the normal white. If he desired to show the very highest honor to a person, would place a kata about a person's neck and would tie a red silk thread with a triple knot into the kata. If at the same time he showed his hands palm up, one was indeed honored. Are of the firm belief that one's whole history is written on the palm of the hand, and the Dalai Lama, showing his hands thus, would prove the friendliest intentions towards one. In later years I had this honor twice. Stewards stood at the entrance, with an assistant on each side. He would bow to new arrivals, accept their kata, and pass it on to the assistant on the left. At the same time the assistant on his right would hand him the correct grade of scarf with which to return the salutation. He would take and place across the wrists, or over the neck, according to rank, of the guest. All these scarves were used and reused. Steward and his assistants were becoming busy. Guests were arriving in large numbers, from neighboring estates, from Lhasa City, and from outlying districts. They all came clattering along the Linker Road, to turn into our private drive in the shadow of the Potala. Ladies who had ridden a long distance wore a leather face mask to protect the skin and complexion from the grit-laden wind. Frequently a crude resemblance of the wearer's features would be painted on the mask. Arrived at her destination, the lady would doff her mask as well as her yak hide cloak. Always fascinated by the features painted on the masks, the uglier or older the woman, the more beautiful and younger would be her mask features. In the house there was great activity. More and more seat cushions were brought from the storerooms. We do not use chairs in Tibet, but sit cross-legged on cushions which are about 2.5 feet square and about 9 inches thick. The same cushions are used for sleeping upon, but then several are put together are more comfortable than chairs or high beds. Arriving guests were given buttered tea and led to a large room which had been converted into a refectory. Here they were able to choose refreshments to sustain them until their real party started. About 40 women of the leading families had arrived, together with their women attendants, being entertained by mother, while others wandered around the house, inspecting the furnishings, and guessing their value.